Breach, your deep dive into authoritarianism and corruption in the era of Trump. I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. If you're enjoying the show, please leave us a review on iTunes. My guest today is Dr. Diane Horvath-Cosper, Reproductive Health Advocacy Fellow at Physicians for Reproductive Health. She's here today to talk about Trump's budget, which would cut Medicaid spending nearly in half and eliminate nearly $13 billion from the budget of the Department of Health and Human Services. The administration has given conflicting answers as to whether it wants these cuts instead of, or in addition to, the multi-billion dollar cuts envisioned by the Republicans' American Health Care Act, which passed the House this month. Diane, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
On the campaign trail, Donald Trump promised that he was never going to cut Medicaid. What happened?
Well, I think the fact that you're asking, it makes it very clear that that is not what happened. This new proposed budget would slash Medicaid by $800 billion over the next 10 years.
And that's possibly over and above anything that's in the American Health Care Act, should it pass in anything like its current form.
That's correct.
So we could be looking at up to $1.4 trillion with a T in cuts to Medicaid alone?
That, you know, I'm not sure of the exact number, but I think the thing to think about is that the ACA, so Obamacare, expanded Medicaid for millions of people, and that resulted in people being able to get coverage when maybe they had been uninsured for 5 or 10 years or more. And so the fact that this just really dismantles the Medicaid system that's actually working so well is pretty terrifying.
And you're a practicing physician in addition to being a policy person, right?
That's correct.
Can you talk a bit about how Medicaid works in your practice and how it affects the patients that you deal with every day?
So right now I'm doing just family planning care. So I'm an OBGYN, and I worked in general OBGYN practice when I came out of residency. So I have some experience dealing with Medicaid. This was prior to the ACA. So I have a lot of stories about, you know, people not qualifying for Medicaid because they were working, you know, two low wage jobs and barely scraping by and didn't qualify under the income guidelines. So I had the, you know, looking back, I've had the good fortune to be able to say that some of those patients were indeed able to get coverage under the ACA, the Medicaid expansion specifically. Now I work in mostly abortion and contraception care. And for my patients, you know, the place that Medicaid comes in is for people who are getting preventive health care at health centers like Planned Parenthood, and they're able to take their Medicaid there to pay for routine primary care.
But it's not true that Medicaid pays for routine abortions, right?
So federally administered Medicaid does not. That's part of the Hyde Amendment, which has been something that's been very discriminatory against low-income people. States can choose to use their own Medicaid-administered, you know, funding to cover abortion services as part of routine women's health care. So in Maryland, abortion care is covered under a certain set of circumstances. And in other states, they have much stricter guidelines about how, if and how Medicaid can be used to pay for abortion care.
It astonished me to learn that 4 out of 10 children and almost half of births in the country are covered under Medicaid.
Yeah, it's a really important program, and it fills a gap in care that would really be devastating when you think about how many people would be uninsured and how many births would not be covered.
And it's interesting also to think people have this sort of stereotypical idea that it's for the poor or the working poor, but it also forms a kind of nursing home social safety net for people who are now middle class.
Sure. Yeah, it's a really, and I think another place where we see it kind of rounding out a system that's there but maybe not adequate is with veterans. So 300,000 plus veterans in the United States are covered under Medicaid, either alone on Medicaid or as a supplement to other care.
And there's all this talk these days about the opioid overdose crisis, too. And even conservative Republicans are saying, hey, wait a minute, if we cut Medicaid, how are we going to provide drug treatment to all these people?
Yeah, I mean, I live and work in Baltimore and D.C., and I think that it's a huge concern. You know, people can have the will to want to go into treatment, but if there are no beds available and mental health services aren't covered, then they really have no place to turn.
Can you describe a bit more about the nuts and bolts of how Obamacare expanded the Medicaid coverage?
So I'm not necessarily a Medicaid expert, but, you know, as a practicing clinician, I think that what I saw that was useful and helpful was that it actually created a fantastic incentive system for states to expand their Medicaid program. So it basically covered, it basically provided 90%+ of the funding for these expansions. So states already had a Medicaid program in place, but, you know, again, the income requirements were such that if you worked a couple of low-wage jobs, you wouldn't necessarily qualify. So as a kind of enticement, the federal government said, well, we'll basically pay for these expansions. And then over the course of the next several years, the states would have to come up with a small percentage of that money in order to continue to maintain the federal funding. But I think the important thing is that the federal government is footing the bill for the vast majority of this expansion, and it was costing states very little comparatively.
And even conservative ideology warriors like Mike Pence, when he was governor of Indiana, responded to that carrot.
Yeah, I mean, it really only made sense. And I think, you know, states looked at this and said, this is money that is, you know, we can have to do this. We have people who need care. We have a gap in coverage that we can identify. And it, you know, I think you can see that the vast majority of the states took the offer.
And how many extra people did the expansion bring on?
You know, I'm not entirely sure what the last figure was. I know that should this budget pass and should the AHCA pass, the CBO's estimated that, 23 million people will lose insurance. And not all of that is Medicaid, but, several million of it is.
And if that were to happen, what would be the impact on just day-to-day public health? What would we expect to see in terms of things like unplanned pregnancy rates?
Well, I think it's really clear from both U.S. and international studies and research that when people have access to preventive care like contraception, the unintended pregnancy rate goes down. I mean, it seems like it wouldn't even be a question that that's the case that that happens, but we actually have data to back it up. And so I think from the perspective of a family planning healthcare provider, you know, this idea that we would pull money away from a program like Medicaid that does provide access to things like prescription drugs, like contraceptives and routine cancer screenings like pap tests. It just, to me, it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make fiscal sense. And it certainly doesn't make sense if we are a country that wants to take care of the people who live here.
Conservatives say that by paying for all this Medicaid for the expansion, that they're taking away the incentives for states to keep healthcare costs down. Does that seem like a fair criticism?
You know, I think that we obviously have a concern in this country with healthcare costs. But, you know, the analysis that I've looked at, and I think, you know, the kind of the numbers in most of the studies that look at the cost of administering these programs actually show that Medicaid is administratively far more efficient than private health insurance plans. So it actually would make more sense if they're looking to cap costs or reduce costs to have fewer plans, to have them more centrally administered and make them look more like Medicaid.
So something closer to single-payer healthcare.
Yes.
It strikes me as really disingenuous when the Republicans talk about wanting to control healthcare costs by pushing more of the burden onto states and cutting the federal investment when the federal government has all this leverage that it could use or already is using to actually bend the cost curve for healthcare, whereas all states can do is just cut benefits.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that it's short-sighted. And I think people want to be able to tell their constituents, oh, look, we voted to, you know, have smaller government or to deregulate or all these like nice buzzwords that we talk about, when what that really means is if you live in a state that values your access to healthcare, then you're lucky. And if you live in a state, maybe even 10 miles across a border, that has decided that things like maternity care is not an essential benefit, then you're looking at, you know, having astronomically higher healthcare costs, or at least the possibility of that happening.
And it seems also like kind of a sneaky backdoor way of cutting benefits, where the Republicans and the federal government will say, oh, well, you know, we're not really cutting it. We're just cutting increases to Medicaid spending. Where at the same time, if you do that and healthcare costs keep rising at the rate they're rising, there's going to be less buying power and the states are just going to have to cut benefits out the back door.
I mean, I think that's one of the state's only tools to keep costs down. Yeah. I mean, I think that's going to be what happens.
So the Republicans in Congress are hoping that they won't take the electoral pain for losing services. Somebody can say, oh, yeah, the state of Indiana took my benefits away. Now I have to give birth in a hallway because of the state of Indiana.
Well, and I think, you know, we've heard people say things like, well, if a person doesn't get the coverage they want in a particular state, then they can just move someplace else. And I think that's just, it's flippant about the reality of people's lives. And it also, again, avoids the question, should your access to healthcare depend on the state you live in? And I think for those of us who see access to care as, you know, something that's a right as opposed to a privilege for the people who can pay, I think that's a terrible kind of value to uphold as a nation, that your access to healthcare depends on the zip code that you have.
And it becomes so restrictive if you have both your rights curtailed by the state you live in and also the kind of work you do. It just seems like Republicans are putting people in tinier and tinier boxes about how they can live and saying that it's about freedom.
Yeah, I think one of the things, and, you know, especially among my colleagues in family planning, it's been kind of like ruefully amusing to hear the rhetoric about freedom and liberty and having choice of healthcare provider and choice in this and that, and then having those same people vote to restrict access to one of the most basic aspects of women's healthcare, which is abortion care and contraception. So, you know, a little bit disingenuous to talk about freedom and then limit freedoms in such a stark way.
What are block grants and why are Republicans so keen on them?
So my understanding of block grants is that the states would get a fixed amount of money to administer all of their Medicaid services. So it's essentially a cap on, you know, the amount of money that a state would get from the federal government. So, you know, once they had reached an enrollment limit, then there wouldn't be any more money because, you know, and the states could, I think they're sold as this idea that the states now have flexibility and choice in how they allocate these funds. But the fact is that there are states that have higher healthcare utilization and more need and a sicker population and, you know, higher percentages of people who are older and access the system more. So I think, you know, the idea of a block grant is basically going to put at risk the people that are already at risk and that thankfully benefited from the Medicaid expansion, but now they go back to being at risk when, if this type of program were to go through.
Mick Mulvaney, the budget director, testified this week that these cuts could be affected without actually affecting any level of service at all. Is there any way that could possibly be true?
Yeah, I think that's a really optimistic, almost naive way to look at this. I think that, you know, there's not an unlimited amount of resources. And if you cut, you know, the budget to a state, and it's less than what they have now, and the population is growing, or the population of people on Medicaid is growing, then I just don't see how you can make up that cost someplace else other than to either deny people coverage or reduce the services that are offered.
And what do you think will happen in terms of other aspects of Trump's budgets? How do those sort of work together in terms of the overall health picture? Things like abstinence-only sex ed, which he's championing $250 million for.
Yeah. So I guess if you really want to have more unintended pregnancies and sexually transmitted infections, then funding abstinence-only education is probably the short train to get there. We know that abstinence-only programs don't prevent unintended pregnancy. They don't result in, you know, any fewer adolescents becoming sexually active. They're just largely ineffective. And so I think that's again, a bone that gets thrown to some of the people who put him in office, which were very socially conservative donors and groups. So that's frightening. And then I think also too, this idea that people will not be able to use their Medicaid at Planned Parenthood health centers when those are actually the clinics that are, you know, sometimes the only ones that are available to people with Medicaid in a particular community.
Trump, back in April, signed some legislation cutting off federal funds to Planned Parenthood. Can you describe how that's going to work?
So the way that this new budget is working for, you know, Planned Parenthood funding, and I think that it's very clear that this idea that Planned Parenthood, you know, should be cut off from any funding whatsoever is a really popular idea among conservatives. And so it sounds like they're trying every avenue that they possibly can to make this happen. And the way that the budget works would be, and obviously this is an aspirational budget, but it definitely tells us the priorities of the administration. But the way that it would work under the budget, if it were to pass as written, is that Planned Parenthood could not participate in any HHS administered programs. So that would include Medicare and Medicaid. So people with Medicaid or Medicare insurance would no longer be able to take it to Planned Parenthood, even though state courts have determined that Medicaid is a qualifying provider and that there's no reason that, you know, a person shouldn't be able to go get a pap test at Planned Parenthood and use their Medicaid.
And all Planned Parenthood's funds are totally sequestered, so there's no actual possibility that the money is going to be used to provide abortions.
No, I mean, that is specifically prohibited by federal law. So the idea that they're taking funds away from Planned Parenthood, whether it's through, you know, not allowing them to participate in Title X family planning programs, which is another part of the budget, because that's an HHS administered program. That just, you know, it's spiteful. Like, it just takes care away from the people who need it most, the populations that are most vulnerable. And it also, paradoxically, increases the chances we're going to have an increase in unplanned pregnancies and unintended pregnancies. I mean, I think, you know, obviously the funds are already not going to abortion care, and to limit funds at this point just tells me that they don't care if poor women have access to cervical cancer screening.
What percentage of abortion is Planned Parenthood's overall budget relative to the amount that they spend of their budget on other kinds of reproductive health?
That I don't know. That's something that I'm sure is available, probably online. I would have to look it up. But I think, you know, people talk about, you know, only 3% of the services are abortion, you know, are involved in abortion care. And, you know, I want to say abortion is just as much an essential health service as contraception. So I think, like, this idea that we're going to de-emphasize that Planned Parenthood is an abortion provider, I think that's silly, because abortion is just as much a part of healthcare as birth control or cancer screenings. But I think that the fact is that there are plenty of Planned Parenthoods that don't even provide abortion. They provide things like primary care and well woman exams and, you know, contraception and STI testing and treatment. So, you know, I don't think there's a need to separate out in our minds necessarily. I mean, comprehensive reproductive health care includes abortion care, but I think that they're much more than just abortion care. I think that they're providing a lot of really essential services in addition to abortion care.
I was filming a documentary last year about abortion care access, and one of the most bizarre and kind of telling scenes that we observed was this Planned Parenthood in the Midwest that does not provide abortion care, never has, but the anti-choicers set up with their sidewalk chalk and write, "Don't abort your baby," just so that they can harass anybody who wants to go in for a pap smear.
Yeah, no, I think that's, you know, that's something we see at a lot of places, and it just kind of blows my mind. Like, I don't really understand why, you know, a Planned Parenthood opening a clinic in a neighborhood is somehow threatening to the people in that neighborhood. People go there voluntarily. They get services voluntarily. It fills an important niche in the community. And we know from looking at the, you know, the capacity and the number of patient visits and things like that, that if Planned Parenthoods were to close or have to, you know, close due to funding cuts, there's not enough spaces in other clinics to take care of the patients who would be displaced.
What does this say about the Trump administration's professed respect for life? We keep reading that maternal mortality is rising and rising in this country.
Yeah, this is a real point of critique, I think, of the so-called pro-life movement, is that where's the outcry about the rising maternal mortality rate and the fact that it's disproportionately impacting communities that already have, you know, difficulty accessing care, like communities of color, immigrant families, adolescents, people who live in rural areas. So I think this idea that, you know, passing restrictions on abortion makes us pro-life is a really ridiculous kind of thing to put forth. Another thing that really makes me question this idea that this administration or that conservatives respect life is that the budget includes really deep cuts to things like, you know, temporary assistance to needy families, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. These are lifelines for families who are struggling to feed their kids. I mean, I think that the idea that you literally want to take food away from poor children is like the most anti-life thing you could possibly do.
And as a doctor, you must sort of think how short-sighted it is to be taking money away from the nourishment of children in terms of their long-term health outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my mom is a teacher, and she spent some time teaching in a school district where a lot of the kids were hungry. There was a lot of food insecurity. And she said that there's no way that kids can pay attention when they're hungry. And so she used to bring snacks for people. And I know a lot of other teachers do the same thing for their students. And it's a real sad commentary that kids literally can't learn if they haven't eaten. And we can't even meet that basic need for people.
It's astonishing to me. Do you think that this is all just political theater on the part of the Trump administration? I mean, it's often said that a presidential budget is a wish list anyway. Do you think that this is just them dragging numbers out of the air in order to make their larger tax cuts and military spending figures work out, knowing full well that they're never actually going to have these cuts?
I can't even pretend to understand the rationale for some of this. I know that the reports I read about the math show that that's not even correct in the budget.
Because they counted the economic growth and the tax cuts.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a little strange. And I know it's a wish list. It's as much a statement of like philosophy and priorities as it is of actual strategy. But that's even more worrisome, to make your aspirational statement of priorities things like cutting food benefits, defunding an organization that provides cancer and primary care, you know, screenings to poor people. Like, this is a really bad set of values to put out there.
What's being done to oppose this on the grassroots level?
Yeah, there's actually a lot going on. And that's one thing that I think is different about the, you know, world kind of climate pre and post election, is that there's a really concerted, much more organized and coordinated effort among advocacy groups. I think you see the results of that, and also just like people's emotions and their anger and their feeling of betrayal at these town hall meetings and on call-in shows. And, you know, these hearing stories about staffers on Capitol Hill who cannot keep up with the number of messages that are being left. You know, every time I call my senators and representative now, you get a busy signal or you get the voicemail because they just don't have the staff to answer all the calls. I mean, I think that's a really good, hopeful thing. And I hope we can keep up that pressure.
What is your org doing to oppose this?
So Physicians for Reproductive Health is a physician-led advocacy organization, and we typically focus most of our advocacy efforts on reproductive health. So things like access to abortion, access to contraception, things like the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, which was protections for pregnant women on the job so that they wouldn't be, you know, illegally terminated for, you know, needing a bottle of water at their workstation or needing a break to go to the bathroom. And we work in coalition with a lot of groups, both at the federal and state level, who are doing a lot of this organizing. So I think there's a recognition that cuts to Medicaid are going to disproportionately harm women and families. And so that's a major reproductive health issue. And so we're working really closely with a lot of other, you know, communications people and other organizations that are organizing, you know, kind of some of these education and feedback sessions for legislators. So it's a busy time.
If someone wants to get active against the Medicaid cuts and they can't make it out to a town hall or the representative won't hold a town hall, what else can they be doing?
I think that calling your officials and calling them regularly. The best advice that I got was put your elected officials' numbers into your phone. And so when you're sitting at your computer and a story pops up and you think, oh, that's a really bad idea, you can just pick up the phone and call. And it can be as simple as, I'm so-and-so, I live in this district, I'm calling to tell, you know, representative so-and-so that this, I think this is a bad idea and here's why. And I think keeping up that pressure and making it a really routine thing to call your officials and let them know that they're not representing you, or that they are, and thank them. So I think that's one thing. I think if you have money to give, then certainly directing it into organizations that are doing meaningful work that you can support. You know, showing up when you can. So even if it's not a town hall meeting, when you can come to a demonstration or you can show up at an office and actually visit your legislators in person, that's really powerful too.
And it's always so important. I'm glad you mentioned the importance of calling your own representatives rather than calling just representatives in general. I think people sometimes get the misconception that calling more reps is more better.
Yeah, no, I think that you, you know, your representatives are really only beholden to the people in their district or in their state, in the case of the Senate. And so, you know, they're the people that, you know, you're as a constituent, you're the person that they want to hear from. And, you know, if you can make a visit to your representative or your senator's local office, if you can't make it to DC, you don't live anywhere close to there, your representatives and your senators have offices in your state, maybe even in your community. And that's a really powerful place to visit as well.
And if people are thinking about getting organized for the midterm elections, where should they be setting their sights?
I think my goal would be to have a makeup in the Senate and the House of Representatives that is going to support things like evidence-based and science-based healthcare policy. And we know that a lot of these things are not evidence or science-based. I would love to see a progressive agenda on reproductive health in terms of protecting the right to have an abortion, the right to access comprehensive contraception, the right to parent the children you may already have in a healthy environment. So protecting access to schools, protecting access and funding for the EPA. I think that's one of the most terrifying things that has come out of this is that, you know, we're looking at places that may not have clean air and water or don't already and are not going to get it. For me, I would love to see a progressive wave move through, but I also think like targeting these districts that are vulnerable is a really good place to start and to put, you know, money and effort and time.
And there are a surprisingly large number of currently Republican-held districts that are quite statistically vulnerable. And there's actually data that says that they've been hurt by the controversy around Republican efforts to derail Obamacare. So I think that's momentum that we could be pushing on.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the AHCA, Trump Care, really unpopular piece of legislation. And, you know, I think they had a real hard time rustling up the votes to pass it, you know, in a thing that should have been an easy sell, and it wasn't. So I think there's a lot of potential there. And I also think, you know, on the Senate level, senators have to answer to their entire state. So they don't have a gerrymandered district that they can count on. They don't have a safe seat. They answer to the entire state. And I think this is a time to let your senators know that, you know, this is unacceptable and you will be, you know, either actively voting for them, you know, voting them out or voting for them, depending on what they choose to do with this bill.
There's been a lot of chatter going around online. I don't know if you've seen it. Indivisible has been tweeting about how supposedly a lot of the Republican senators have been saying that this upcoming recess is the time when they're going to be taking the pulse of their district and seeing whether there's actually support to pass their health care bill. And do you give credence to that? Do you think that they might actually withdraw it if constituents push hard enough?
I absolutely think that they might, you know, maybe not withdraw it, but just not consider it, not move it forward. There's a lot of ways that this bill could kind of fizzle out.
But they could, it's realistic to think they might just let it die and not introduce their own counterpart to the House bill.
Yeah, they definitely could. I mean, I think that what they hear on this recess, what they continue to hear over the next couple of weeks, I mean, I think that's going to be really telling. And, if there's the first priority beyond, you know, representing the constituents is to stay elected and to get reelected so you can continue to do this work. And I think the representatives and senators are really keenly aware of how that type of opposition looks and, you know, that people who are upset or feel like they're not being heard are going to tell 10 of their friends. And that's what we should be doing.
Diane, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
On Wednesday, May 31st, Rewire Radio's storytelling series, Choiceless, is back with a 4-part miniseries examining historical instances of healthcare injustice and the medical advancements they help make possible. The first episode details the reckless birth control trials in Puerto Rico in the middle of the 20th century. Learn how and why 3 women died and countless others were harmed in the pursuit of progress. Search Choiceless in your favorite podcast app and subscribe. Each week on The Breach, I recommend some reading. This week's pick is an essay by Adam Serwer on the Atlantic's website. It's called The Lesser Part of Valor, and it's a meditation on Montana congressional candidate Greg Gianforte's unprovoked body slam of reporter Ben Jacobs and the differences between liberal and conservative views of toughness. Right-wingers cheered Gianforte's attack as the action of a manly man and a real tough guy, even though grabbing a reporter in the middle of an interview was nobody's idea of a fair fight. Gianforte apologized, but only after he was elected, suggesting that he knew the body slam would appeal to Republican voters. The idea of a fair fight is essential to the liberal ideal of toughness. You see it celebrated in Hollywood movies. On this view, there's nothing brave about crushing someone just because they're too weak or too surprised to fight back. On the contrary, the defense of the weak is the purest expression of bravery. The conservative ideal of bravery has always been different. Serwer takes us back to 1856 when pro-slavery Senator Preston Brooks ambushed abolitionist Charles Sumner in the Senate and beat the unarmed senator unconscious before he could even get to his feet. Southern commentators hailed Brooks as a real tough guy. Serwer argues that then, as now, authoritarian conservatives saw no contradiction between being tough and punching down. On the contrary, in their view, being tough meant punching down by controlling and indeed owning weaker people. That's it for recommended reading. The Breach is produced by Rewire Radio. Our executive producer is Mark Folletti. Our producer is Nora Hurley. Our theme music is Dark Alliance, performed by Darcy James Argue's Secret Society. And I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. Tweet your suggestions, comments, and questions to @Beierstein, Beierstein, on Twitter. See you next week!